Okay, we're going to get started. Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. My name is Matt Browning. I am one of a number of members in the collective TARL that organizes the attendance exhibition here. I'm also a student at the University of British Columbia, where they just graduated with their MFA, and studying alongside Lee over the course of this year, it was very interesting to see, as the description of their work indicates, how quickly the materials get sort of hashed and rehashed, metabolized and re-metabolized, and churned through over the process of moving in a direction with the work. And so, even though Lee just showed work at the Belkin, it seemed fitting to offer an exhibition shortly after that to allow sort of like metabolic process that was moving through the Belkin to continue into Arts Week and into a space that was strictly available to Lee. And so it was wonderful to work alongside Lee on this project and with the other members of the collective. And without further ado, I'll let Lee talk about their work.
Thanks.
Hey.
Hi, welcome everyone. Thank you for coming. my practice. I guess the whole talk would be orientated around this idea of how do we mark difference in the visual field but subtract it from the logic of identity politics, which I've made the polemical assertion that it's reached a sort of hegemonic state. So, to start with the polemic, this is a quote by this anthology, Queer Ultraviolence and Abash Anthropology, and I'll just read it. Identity politics are fundamentally reformist and seek to find a more favorable relationship between different subject positions rather than default structures that produce those positions from the beginning. Identity politics oppose classism while being content to leave class society intact. So that's a familiar sort of criticism. Any resistance to society must foreground the destruction of the subjectifying processes that reproduce society daily. It must destroy the institutions and practices that racialize and engender bodies within the social order. With the revolution complete, the black flag burned, the category of queer must too be destroyed. Bashback isn't about sustaining identities, it's about destroying them. So instead of sort of getting into what is this sort of oppositional blocking of positions between what kind of black is called the identity artist and the identity critic, I'm interested in pushing beyond that. And I think that the latter half of this quote enables me to do so. And so that's focusing on these sort of subjectifying processes that reproduce society and the potential of affirming different ones. So I'm going to sort of mix this up with reading things and then hopefully, if I relax, doing more of it like ad lib. I want to move beyond the contested quality of the first half of the quote and its oppositional polemics. I'd like to find a way to think beyond the stalemate between kind of black is outlined as the deadlock between the identity artist and the identity critic. To do so, let's focus on the latter half of the quote and the notion that we must destroy the subjectifying processes that reproduce society daily. I would also qualify this assertion by adding that the deconstruction of the processes and institutions of subjectivization that reproduce capitalist totality requires the affirmation of new subjectifying procedures, that is, new content. There is no unmediated relationship to the real. Let's see what I have here. So this is the first work, and this is an image from the exhibition Slip the Snare for my part of our graduate exhibition. And it's called I Struggle With You Against the Laws of Gravity. And yeah, that text is actually taken from Monique Wittig's book, The Lesbian Body. So on the left here is a sort of veil or barricade, depending on how you see it. And in the back is a work called Dollar Store Subjection, Fraternity, Egality, and Liberty. So, I'm going to read another quote. So everything, I'm going to start with a sort of discussion of color, as it's become really, so I've become interested in it, and beyond just the fact that I always loved it. You know, like, modernist painting seduced me at a young age, and sort of cliche like Picasso, and then I think later I realized that it was the color that seduced me. look at sort of Chris Divas' thinking of color and what David Batchelor outlines as chromophobia, which is a sort of disdain for color in Western culture. And it'll all sort of take us into Marisa Lazzarato's work on semiotic pluralism. So here's a quote by Marisa Lazzarato. Folding these modes of expression over signifying semiotics is a political process since, on the one hand, the appropriation of meaning is always an appropriation of power, and on the other, there can be no meaning or representation independent of the dominant significations and representations. The power to act of linguistic and non-linguistic signs must bend to the logic of representation and signification, which neutralize and repress all other functions of language and science. There is a claim shared by both the capitalist logic of disciplinary societies and the logic of socialism and communism. The relationship with the real has to be mediated. Without signification and without representation, there is no access to the real. And this all, I think, is working off the influence of psychoanalysis to materialist theories of power and trying to understand sort of what happened post-68. So in the tradition of the workers' movement, politics is not possible without realization or signification, without representation of all the people, of the people or of the working class by the party. The ties between semiotics and politics, between the government of science and the government of the political arena are very close indeed. So that's an important point. This tie between semiotics and politics, between the government of science and the government of the political arena are very close indeed. And that's sort of where I'm locating my, what I've kind of thought of as an objective look at queer politics, is this disjunction between the government of science and the government of politics. So that is referring back to this idea of this, the necessity of representation, the necessity of mediation, which goes against that first quote and this thing around just like a pure destruction of the subjectivizing, I can never say that word, even though it's like the main point of my whole practice. that you can't just have this pure act of destruction. And that's something that Alain Badiou, someone who's pretty important to me, and he says that, you know, the 20th century was defined by this sort of destruction, and that we need to move towards a more subtractive procedure, which involves a sort of affirmation as well. So I might get into thinking about subtraction. This is where my work situates itself. I practice both discursively and practically, think through the logics of dominant subjectivization and the ways in which representation is both integral to these processes and to their resistance. I work from the premise that it is impossible to live in unmediated relation to the real. And the real in this lens is to the relations of production, to the real sort of social exploitation and violence that are sort of unintelligible within any sort of state of situation. That we cannot close the gap between the real and semblance of any situation entirely, but that we can point to the gap, silences, and absences. We can construct counter-representational programs that support and reproduce an egalitarian society that purge the dominant ideology and its domination from our resistance movements. So that's probably a bit theory-heavy beginning. But so yeah, this work, I Struggle With You Against the Laws of Gravity, was this sort of real, starting to really think through color and its place within Western philosophy. And the Pride Flags became this perfect thing to work with because it's primary and secondary colors. I could cut them up and I could start this sort of cursory job of painting with the fabric and the lines. And so this one was sewed, they were cut up and then sewed with complementary colors into a loop, which, this is moving on me, I feel like. That is part of that sort of big banner there on the left. And so we'll get into some ideas around color. So there is going to be some reading. So David Batchelor has talked about this sort of like distrust of color in Western philosophy as found in writing of philosophers, cultural theorists, artists. And this sort of, it comes down to this like fear of contamination by color, because it's this sort of unbounded, decentered force that's not totally understood. I mean, it is more so now, but that, so here it is. Chromophobia manifests itself in many and varied attempts to purge color from culture, to devalue color, to diminish its significance, to deny its complexity. More specifically, the purging of color is usually accomplished in one of two ways. In the first, color is made out to be property of some foreign body, usually the feminine, the oriental, the primitive, the infantile, the vulgar, the queer, the pathological. In the second, color is relegated to the realm of the superficial, the supplementary, the inessential, the cosmetic. In one, color is regarded as alien and therefore dangerous, and the other is perceived merely as a secondary quality of experience, and thus unworthy of serious consideration. Color is dangerous, or is trivial, or is both. Either way, color is routinely excluded from the higher concerns of the mind. It is other to the higher values of Western culture. Or perhaps culture is other to the higher values of color. Or color is the corruption of culture. Which is a really nice statement that, if you're familiar with Kristeva's work, makes sense. And... So I started to think about sort of the properties of color, and I like this idea of queer or color as other, and standing in for these philosophical categories I was very interested in, the feminine being one through sort of psychoanalysis and Western philosophies and oppositions between form and matter, and so I got really excited about the feminine. As sort of explained in French feminism, and their sort of feminine a creature movement, which sort of attempts to write the female body into language, and so it's like write the morphology of the female body into essentially the phallocentric language. And let's see what I have here. So yeah. So this idea that color is sort of charm or artifice or cosmetic is important, and I kind of celebrated that. And this picture is really intense. So I celebrated that with like and head up like bows, and wasn't afraid of it, let's just say.
So I was also starting to begin doing these kind of task-oriented
orientated work. So I collected garbage from Belkin and I tried to see how much garbage I could glue onto a canvas and with paint and have it sort of glued on with paint in a horizontal space, obviously, and then lift it up into vertical space and have it hold the weight of the garbage by the paint. So I got it about a foot on each canvas of their garbage, and then they eventually collapsed. So I succeeded in my task. And in the end, I ended up just taking all the garbage and sort of schlooping it together into the sculpture here and presenting it spray painted blue. So I collected garbage from Belkin for a few months and set myself the task of gluing the garbage down with gesso. The glue would be a sheen covering over or pulling together the total opacification of the structure by the garbage. I applied the glue because I hoped it would work against the opacification of the structure. That is, that it would undermine the iconography of the institution, like Giotto. And that's Kristeva's argument, is that the color in the Padua Chapel, the blue, is sort of... Giotto was this like very sort of flat painter, so this is kind of the idea that he was like a precursor to some of the blue fields in this chapel were a precursor to modernist color field painting, and that because of the affective qualities of color and its sort of function as a semiotic property. So what she's saying with that is that the semiotic is like the affective dimensions of language, the sort of rhythms of the body, and it sort of often will be set in opposition to the symbolic, which is like the structure, the grammar of language. And so her idea is that the color was sort of undermining the iconography. It was putting pressure of the sensible on the form. And that was sort of an inherently liberatory experience because you as a subject that's interpreted in language were being sort of undermined by these forces that are trans-individual. So they don't build you up as a subject. They kind of cross individuals. And so yeah, I was kind of like, okay, well, if that works for him, maybe it'll work for me. So it was hopeful or idealistic. So what am I saying here? So paradoxically, even though Western imperialism or democratic materialism controls the regime of the visible, it is almost impossible to conceive of it in an image, in a totalized manner. Globalization and colonization have rendered the abstractness of global political economy incomprehensible. This point aligns with Alberto Toscano's work, Cartographies of the Absolute, that asks the question, can capital be seen? This work asserts that we are in a similar position as Giotto, the absolute of our times, the god of our times, capital, that enables the entire scene of the visible to exist, does not indeed have a dominant ideology, that is, representational program for reality. And yet, but that it can be pictured. The absolute exceeds representation. A crucial problem in orientating oneself in the world today is the level of abstraction that pyramids our life. And this is a quote from the book. Once reality has migrated into abstract economic functions, it can no longer be read in human faces. Observations of life in the former colony where social divisions remain stark, so what we can see, might then be more rewarding, we think. But such concreteness is suspect, since the abstractions of the world market are never far away and belie the fullness of spontaneous perception at every moment. So unlike the Catholic Church, with its clear narrative program and cognitive map of social totality in which subjects can orientate themselves, how do you do that today? And I'm going to read another quote. One of the reasons we have latched onto the phrase photographies of the absolute is because of how it encapsulates the problem of visualizing or narrating capitalism today. The absolute is a theological and then a philosophical category, gesturing towards that which defies representation, which contrasted to our mortal perception is infinite and unencompassed. Cartographies of the absolute is a willfully paradoxical expression, but one that directs us toward the way in which picturing our social and economic world is a predicament at once technical and, so to speak, philosophical. Capitalism, after all, is a religion of the everyday life, an actual existing metaphysics. So I started working with blue and gold. And maybe it's not so much like that I can like picture, and that's the argument in the book, is that you can't render it visible, but you can approach its limits. You can approach the places where it can't cover all the bases. And this is sort of like, these works are, again, pride flags, spray painted gold, or cut and wrapping frames, the gold works on the left and the right of this trinity. And yeah, I'm concerned with, so in this work, by utilizing the colors of the Padua Chapel, I'm making an attempt to picture or render visible an iconography of capital, or at least point out the lack of one. I'm also positioning normative queer politics as an integral part of the regime of visibility of the empire. The goal references the halos of the angels. Empire's crown and glory, the inclusion of marginalized folks, of free sexuality, gay marriage, gays in the military. To say that queer politics is a visible component of an invisible totality, a part of a whole, I'm interested in what it covers over. What part of the struggles have entered the realm of the visible and which ones have not, and why? That's kind of my whole thing. Is like, what can never enter the realm of the visible? And like, where, that's probably where, that's at least where I want to focus my attention. And I'll, Elaine Boudouze has this manifesto for contemporary art that has some more sort of provocative statements. Today, art can only be made from the starting point of that which, as far as empire is concerned, doesn't exist. Through its abstraction, art renders the inexistence visible. This is what governs the formal principles of every art. The effort to render visible to everyone that which for empire, and so by extension for everyone, doesn't exist. Since it is sure of its ability to control the entire domain of the visible and audible by the laws governing commercial circulation and democratic communication, empire no longer censors anything. All art and all thought is ruined when we accept the permission to consume, to communicate, and to enjoy. We should become the pitiless censors of ourselves. And finally, it is better to do nothing than to contribute to the invention of formal ways of rendering visible that which empire already recognizes as existing. So it's a bit harsh, but it's, I think, provocative and motivating. So all this work with color and the aspects and properties of it and its relationship to the maternal or the semiotic aspect of language is kind of bringing me to Marisa Lazzarato's work, which sort of ruined color for me. Well, not ruined it, but it made it more contradictory. In that, if you're familiar with Lazzarato's work, he's really trying to challenge people to sort of look at the way that there's two forms of sort of subjection in capitalism. There's the one that we're aware of, which is, in general sort of logocentric political discourse of your sort of interpolation by language into roles and identities and sort of like your construction as an I. And then there's this other realm that he talks about, which is the sort of realm of machinic enslavement, which operates on that level of affect and intensity, but has nothing to do with you as an I. It actually sort of deterritorializes you as an I. And it's exactly the sort of part of the semiotic that the feminine is. So the semiotics of the body. And there's sort of increasing awareness and conversation around affects and its affect intensity. It's basically trans individual. So where are we? So as I was kind of starting to read into Lazzarato's work, and so color is this sort of a signifying property. And I'm still like, I'm more sitting in the contradiction, you know, that it's like, color isn't inherently liberatory as it's instrumentalized on a different register, as it's said in the sort of, in the artist statement, but that doesn't mean that, you know, we can necessarily find a place that it's not sort of contradictory in that way. So it's like, how do you use these technologies that are used against us in many ways for more sort of liberatory practices or, and really it's sort of, polemic is like, move away from a politics that's just based on signification. Like, let's figure out a politics that's based on expression and experimentation, because capital is the semiotic operator, right? right? So it's like, and that's something that is a very passive position. So this work, these are projects again, and you can't really see, but there's objects sort of mixed in with the fabric. And what I did was I set out the task, like the pride flags came from the dollar store in the first place, and then I went to the dollar store and I needed to find objects that would fit into genre painting, so portrait, toilet, and like still life, that would match the exact color of the fabric. And so these are the paintings, and yeah, they're sort of, they're wrapped around the structure, which is something that I do many times, and they're tied with bows. And so as I'm kind of doing this research on the sort of disjunction between interpolation by ideology, that Louis Althusser is sort of famous for explaining, and then this other realm of affect and sort of the machinic realm, that the idea is that if you're a subject, you're basically using the machine, but if you're machinically enslaved, you're like part of the machine. And it's complicated, and I'm not really going to, probably just going to stay that way, but it's really important because it's not in the realm of the visual. It doesn't make it necessarily into intelligibility and dominant sort of political resistance or... And that's because of the sort of larger centricism of a Western humanist subject, which at the end of the day, that is one of the big problems. And so I kind of realized after I made this work, I was like, whoa, this is actually a pretty good model of the subject, as sort of understood through Lacan and his idea of the signifying chain, which was kind of surprising and not intentional. And that's the thing about practice, I think, is that because art has this privileged relationship to the sensuous, to sense, there's a split between the realm of the sensible and the realm of the intelligible as a result of certain divisions of labor. And so you're always kind of doing this relay of trying to like catch up to what it is that you're doing in material practice, because and that's sort of Badiou's idea of the inesthetic, is this sort of not resorting to either like basically getting out of the deadlock of like pure flight to the realm of the intelligible, say like conceptual art, or pure flight to the realm of the sensible, which could be sort of like thought of as say between like vitalism and Plato or something. So like subtracting from that logic. And sort of bringing the sensible into intelligibility and marking shifts in the sort of the relationship between form and sense that happen as sort of like deterritorializations happen. And subjection is constant, and so it's like there's these sort of decompositions and recompositions, and within them there's sort of opportunities to like turn it around. And then I always get lost. okay. So another thing, quickly, I won't be able to really get into it, is that the idea of it being a sort of like window frame with a bed sheet tied off and coming out of it, it was taken from this image of from print media in the 18th century of Jack Sheppard, who was this notorious sort of prison breaker. Jordana Rosenberg is a queer Marxist theorists, and they have an article called Trans War by the War Boy, the Primitive Accumulation of Testosterone, and so the idea is that they're really trying to push back against these trends in queer subcultures around like individual self-determination, individual gendered self-determination, and the idea is that like it has to be collective, and so in this legend he is continually breaking out of prison. And at the time, they're just instituting sort of contemporary property relationships as we know them. And there was this debate between the state and capitalists of like, should the incarcerated body
be used for anatomical dissections or for indentured labor. And so the modern medical industry is obviously like intimately tied up with these anatomical dissections of incarcerated bodies, and they're linking that into sort of how testosterone had become this raw material of gender that it could be traded in exchange like a commodity. And not to say that it was like some sort of like easy line to connect it, but that's the history. And so at the end of this myth, or not myth, the story, he ends up getting hung. But instead of the mob was really sort of like the mob's desire for him was sort of fanned by the print media. And the mob feared that his body would get dissected, so after he was hung, the mob stormed the gallows and stole the body and buried it. And so that's kind of where this interest in rope came from, was this sort of metaphorical idea of like jailbreaking the body, and it's metaphorical, but there's this sort of real like historical relationship between the property and identity, and sort of contemporary identity and politics and taxonomies and stuff. So, and the self and the subject, and so that's where the rope came from. But, and then I sort of, in this show, I wanted to transition from being this metaphorical idea of, like, literally it's simple, but just, like, take the pride flags and away from this, like, act of signification and turn them into this object that has a use. And, like, let's get out of all the options that are, like, presented to us because they all suck. Within a sort of, like, representational politics, within parliamentary democracy. So that's sort of a transition that happened between that show and this show. I'm not going to get super into what thinking through like the philosophy of the material or the technology and the kind of subjectivizations that it provides. But, and you know, we kind of reduced it to this idea of like rope is either quantification because it had this relationship to the measurement of earth for taxation purposes, or it has this like opportunity to like, you know, basically take flight or leave or escape or, you know, and that's kind of with everything. There's this sort of paradoxical quality to it. Let's see what else I have here. So, I think I need to read a long thing by Lazzarotta. If I can find it. Servitude, which is predicated on a subject agent, with some sort of free will that chooses to do these things, that really, and Spinoza sort of offers this, that in the end of the day, that a different mechanism of alienation, the real chains are those of our affects and desires. There's no such thing as voluntary servitude. There's only passionate servitude, that however is universal. But really just focusing on this level of affect and desire and domination that... that, say, Lazzarato complicates even Althusser's program of interpolation because there's this affective realm that's been underscored within Western democracy is predicated on a liberal humanist subject. But it's also because of that realm, a sort of feminist problem around the body and these sort of other registers of the semiotic that Lazarus was really trying to sort of like push language and its sort of dominance out from the fact that there's multiple semiotic systems at play at a given moment. But sadly, that in like postmodernism, language has taken on this like extreme sort of central role in communicative capitalism and the way that the service industry works. Let's see if I have one thing about works here. So maybe we'll just finish with some thinking about the works in the show. Sorry about the quality, but so we have this, so it's kind of like the rope was this nice way of thinking about subjection as this sort of like binding of the rope, and then like desubjectivization as this sort of unbinding of the rope. And the plastic that's in the window there was twisted into a rope, and then it was, which is like the work that doesn't exist in the office, but then it was sort of pulled apart, and that really like this way that like through the process of binding, the language was being eroded. And so I'm working with that one, the text that was being gestured at but never written, was Clarice Lispector's work, The Passion of G.H., who Hélène Sue sort of celebrated as being like one of the only true feminine creature writers. And that book is all about this sort of like deconstruction of the subject, the sort of like merger with the world, and the sort of trying to push past the limitations of language, that, you know, language is inherently the negation of the media world. It's not, you know, words don't refer to things, they refer to other words. So, and the sort of the phallocentricism of language and women's asymmetrical relationship to it. And so Carlo Cardi is an Italian painter who worked with Carla Lonzi in this sort of Italian feminist movement. And so she does these works on transparencies where she does these repetitive gestures that are sort of seen to be the repetitive gesture of like feminized labor. And that transparency obviously has a long history in social realism, this idea of flatness. And so flatness becomes glass or window, which, you know, so that you have this unmediated look at the relations of society as modeled in painting and by the avant-garde and stuff. But so she's taking the transparency that was being used, and she's using opaque color to make her mark. So I think there's something there about the opacity of that labor within an otherwise seemingly transparent society and relationships with within the Marxist movement. But and then the transparency blocks a certain kind of free look inside this space, and so it sort of softens that sort of optical privileging of what has been called like the scopic regime, and so that's of course like painting is, it has this relationship to opticality that is always sort of based on a sort of repression of a certain kind of corporal enjoyment or embodiment, and so there's much talk about sort of this like the withholding of vision as being something that might
boxes I was thinking about. Can't really see it, but the pizza box itself is kind of an amazing painting because it's this place in where oil is going to split either to sort of go into representation, say like oil painting, or it's going to support cellular life and food. And so I kind of wanted to force that, like set back into the representational field. Because the idea, of course, is that vision is privileged over other senses, and painting doesn't often do much to challenge that. So, wrapping up. So, this robe, I think, again, is pointing out that it's a bit of a panorama. It's a horizontal line anchored at the traditional Bian kind of painting. However, the normal sort of presence-absence relationship you would have with a painting and a wall is different, and that it's the wall, and then there's a gap at the door, which is important. And then, so kind of in the end here, I continue to explore the feminine, that part of the symbolic semiotic repressed by logocentric discourses and the masculine humanist subject formation, not only important for thinking the specificity of female morphologies and its relationship to enunciating female subjectivity, but also for adequately dealing with the control side of capitalist reproduction, the machinic enslavement of pre-individual intensities and affects. The fact being that post-fordist labor, technological innovations, the feminization of the workforce are dissolving phallic models on all sides, however, this does not mean that this process is inherently liberatory. And that's, here, I think there's one last thing I want to. So I was playing around with that work, with this idea of like a dual frame structure. Yeah, so I'm very excited. theoretical stuff I've introduced doesn't just like pull back into the work in a sort of like didactic way, but I guess I'm like this like renegade philosopher of things and sort of how this sort of like unfixing in sort of semiotic systems relates to transgender politics and wanting that thing of differentiating what is sort of the potentials for collective practices of re-subjectivization that I think are happening there, but like what isn't necessarily just like liberation, and it's actually sort of a more insidious enslavement in a sense. Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's just like yeah, that Giordano Bruno work, I don't know if you've read their work. They're really good because they sort of, I think pushing back against politics that reduce everything down to like individual choice and responsibility is important because that's the sort of inherently liberal bourgeois kind of notion of political action as opposed to like the mob or the collective or the party where you like unwork your individual, you know, you unwork yourself in relationship to others, you know, like an openness to others. And so, I mean, I have, in practice, I think that's like where art has always been this like privileged sort of protector of the collective aspect of artistic practice. And then it's really hard to maintain practice on your own. You know, and that's one way of like working in with others in artist-run centers or like facilitating your own sort of practice with others. And that, and seeing that I haven't really been able to maintain it when I've kind of gotten cast out. And school obviously provides that. And then politically, like, so those are also like two separate things I think that I'm trying to figure out how to like separate is that like art has its own truths and it's long been sutured to politics in a way that kind of overdetermines it, but like there are things I do in my own sort of my own life with collective living and stuff that I think push against those sort of forces of individualism that sadly undermine these desires to initiate gender autonomously or but actually one thing I think is really useful for queer politics for me now is thinking through it through a social reproduction lens. And so which is just a shift back to a sort of looking at the ways that labor and that we just can't take sexuality out from the rest of life. and so that's something that I think is strong in my practice is sort of this balancing act between queer theory but also Marxist feminism and that those things together are really, really strong. But that Marxist feminism has really been like underscored in relationship to queer theory, I think, and that I think it's coming back a lot. Like right now in town, there's like the fraud of love happening. There's lots of things where it seems to kind of be making a resurgence. But yeah, so I think thinking queerness through a social reproduction lens is a way of sort of like recentering the collective as the source of political action, as opposed to this just over focus on individual responsibility. Which is part of it, but that you kind of, you know, they say that, like, you can't really affect, like, on your own, you know? So, so that's not really, like, a blueprint. That's my thinking around that, at least. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your presentation. It's a lot of material that I hadn't seen before. It was really exciting to encounter. You know, coming to the opening and seeing the work and then coming to the talk today, the big thing on my mind, and then listening to the talk, was why do you continue to contextualize it by drawing attention to these individual identities when it's not purely visible in the work? And it seems to me that the strength of the work is formal. This act of binding and unraveling and transparency, and I just wonder why is it just because you want to continue to draw on the conversations of those histories, or is there another reason that you continue to individualize your subject even while you try to break it down?
Through, like, referencing theorists, or
by saying it, by putting them in text for the exhibition. When it, I mean, I can't. The Pride Flight ones in the Falcon show seem much more articulated as a sign. This is not visible. I didn't know that the articulation, for me, brought more content to it. So I just wondered, what's your impulse around that?
Oh, even naming that—that's what it is.
exhibition specifically around identity. When it seems like if your other primary interests are economic and social architectural, that the work formally addresses that really well.
Yeah, I think that's a good point around like spending less time criticizing the thing that you're not into and just affirming what you're into, which is something I think that subtraction does. And maybe I agree that like I'm a little more behind this show than I was that show, which is why I'm talking more about it.
Yeah.
Other than the fact that like there's, you know, there's things that are happening, but that formalism is something very important. These, I hope, do kind of do that, affirm something other than that what I've sort of just spent an hour breaking down. But it's on its own register, you know? So, but yeah, it's a good point.
I know when I was a young artist and curator, there was things that I had to do because I had to do them. Mm-hmm. That I had to go through them that were really about me.
Yeah.
So I wonder if it was a little bit of that. Of just like work that you need to do.
Right. Yeah, I think that this, I've had pretty big shifts, like going back and doing 2 years of intensive like practice and reading and so moving forward. Maybe that's that thing, right? That gap between what is intelligible and what isn't is always sort of like you're always a little bit behind. So maybe that's kind of what's happening a little bit. Is like what I can I can render intelligible about my own practice is what I said, and then there's always this other element, and I think that's kind of like art's job, right? But maybe there is too much of a gap there for you.
I just don't know why you continue to articulate it textually in that way, when actually it seems like your ambition is to create a new type of logic, and that visual formal logic is a different type of logic, and that you're actually achieving that. Mm-hmm. I think you're working too hard.
Probably.
It was a weird compliment of sorts.
Thank you.
Not to rush to your defense or something, but I think that maybe that's part of what I was getting at with the like destruction for subtraction move with the fried flags, right? Like I think what perhaps you're identifying as like very legible in the Belgian show is that there was a fairly like visible retainer of some of the information that the pride flag held, like the colors were still there.
There was a pride flag.
Right, so it was more of a clearly kind of like destructive gesture. The residue of the sign existed, you saw that the sign was being broken down and reappropriated into something else, and so this sort of like violence of that destructive act like was foregrounded as one of the main gestures of that.
As one of the main content, yeah.
But if Lee talks about being interested in not necessarily the destructive act, but the subtractive act, because the subtractive act leads to a sort of like generative like affirmation of something else, right? A movement in a new direction that isn't purely about knocking something down. Maybe this show, in its like formal distance and semiotic distance from the flag, but still using the flag, is like the beginning of that generative, affirmative movement in a new direction while using a material that is familiar and yes, has like a sort of previous history in one's practice, but has become like purely immaterial at this point for that formal exercise.
But it's still important to gesture to where it's moving from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
This is why you get to work with curators.
Well, that's the thing. It's like if the logic exceeds this sort of hegemonic thing that's there, it's less legible. It's less easy to staple language on it in a way. But so I'll probably be doing that work, that translation, moving forward.
That being said, in more of like an anecdotal way, I remember the shootings that happened in Orlando, and there was like this pride flag like flurry, right, that was happening. And then I was thinking, well, if you were to come in here, you would just see them essentially like nodded up.
again.